No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. And today we have a special guest, and we're excited to have Jill Lawrence. Jill is an award-winning journalist, and she's an opinion writer and author of The Art of the Political Deal, How Congress Beat the Odds and Broke Through Gridlock. And we all want to know how that happened. So, Jill, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. And I should add to my bio that I have lived in the District of Columbia for over 40 years, I guess, since 1982. So I've covered politics all that time, and I have never voted for a U.S. senator or a House representative who votes on the floor.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a shame, isn't it? And I'm telling you, I'm looking at your bio right now, which I can't read because it's so long that it would take the whole show. And I've also seen your picture. So if you've been in the district for 40 years, you must have moved in when you were 2 years old. But it's I've been in the district 40 years too, and I've got the gray hair to prove it. And I've never voted for anybody that had a vote on the floor, and it's ridiculous. And I got just before we get started, I got into this battle because my great-great-great-great-grandfather fought in the Continental Army, and I went to DAR one day and looked him up, found out about his he was 17 years old when he enlisted, and I thought to myself, how stupid is this that it's 200 years plus years later and I still don't have the rights that he put his life, liberty, and property on the line to get for him and his posterity. So that's what started me on this journey. It's been 18 years and I've been proud to represent the district, but unfortunately, I don't get to really represent the district. I get to talk to people like you, and it's a wonderful thing to do. It's been a wonderful journey, but we need so much more, right? 700,000 people without a vote.
But I know. In fact, if I could just put a plug in right here, right now, I'm just embarking on a project with a friend who's a food writer and historian, Laura Kuman. It's called With Recipes and Justice for All, a D.C. Voting Rights Cookbook.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, she's written about how the suffragists managed to win broader acceptance for the women's vote by publishing cookbooks. It's a great unifier and community tool, so we're hoping that we can get this done too, and we're just starting the project, and anyone who's interested can get in touch with me or with Laura. She's a food blogger, and I really have high hopes for this.
Well, give us the information. How do people get in touch with you and get in touch with
Okay,
Laura?
Well, there's an email address, cookbook4DC@gmail.com. And we're looking for, recipes, or if you know people who have, who are chefs and have their own recipes, it's got to be people's own recipes, or, celebrities or sports figures or anyone who might have something to say, not just in the district, but from anywhere in the country about voting rights or statehood, because this is a long time cause. I've written reams about this, as I'm sure you have. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to raise national awareness of what's going on here, because so many people still don't realize that we have taxation without representation, which is,
yes,
you know, what led
really
to America.
Our problem. Yeah, it's really our problem is getting outside the District of Columbia, because if
exactly.
we could bestow statehood
we
upon ourselves, we would have done it years ago, but we need support, and there are several projects going on. We have one young man who's out there, and he's getting people to commit to stand up for D.C. statehood when they run for political office, and a lot of them don't get elected the first time, but we know through the election process that a lot of people that don't get elected the first time get elected the second or third time. So he's really raising awareness. I just came back from Nebraska, where I spoke before the Senate in Nebraska, and they're considering a resolution to support D.C. statehood. So we really need to get outside, and I just want to put in, now there's no pressure here, but I do make the best marinara sauce on the face of the planet. And I want to share that recipe. It's my Italian grandmother's it's my Italian grandmother's recipe, and I've been making it for years for my friends, and they love it. So, and I have a couple of other things, too, that I make. Plus, I'm married to a gourmet cook. She's just, like, off the hook. So,
all right, well, we'll definitely pursue this.
Yeah,
yes,
we even have a family recipe book that my wife did a few years ago. So we have a whole bunch
amazing.
Of cool recipes. And I think that's a really cool idea. And certainly we will have you and Laura back on the show at some point to promote it, because I think it's just a really great idea. So let's start with your book, okay, The Art of the Deal, Congress Breaking Through Gridlock. I'd like to know, you know, what you have to say on that subject, because that's all we talk about here in Washington now, is how Congress is stuck and can't get anything done. So how did they do it?
Well, this book is from, the deals were done in 2014, 2015, you know, you see things kind of ebb and flow depending on election years. And you also have to have people who are free to negotiate and who are willing to negotiate. And so, you know, I was just kind of leaving the book, which has a picture of a sunrise on it, and I can't tell you how hard I worked to make sure it wasn't a sunset. It wasn't instead a sunrise. But it, you know, I look in the book, and on every page there are relevant things. I was looking at something about a big environmental bill that grew from some tiny two-page bill or something like that, and Democrats were running the table, and they, you know, they were, you know, pretty ruthless. They didn't have to negotiate with Republicans, and so they didn't for the most part. But so here's the description a Democrat gave me, that success came down to you got what you wanted in a version you were willing to live with, and that other thing you didn't want, we got it to where you could tolerate it. And that, to my mind, pretty much describes the immigration bill, that the compromise that Kyrsten Sinema and Chris Murphy and Jim Langford worked out in the Senate. That was just the most intensive labor, because Republicans had asked for this on a national security bill for Ukraine and Israel and Gaza humanitarian aid. So, you know, it seemed like the absolute ideal political negotiation. And, you know, it was tanked by Donald Trump, because he's running for office. And, you know, the fact that he wasn't running for office and seemed possibly to be a spent force in 2021 and 2022 is the reason that I could actually write a column about the golden era of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill, because that was actually working out. There was so much accomplished. You know, there was the bipartisan infrastructure bill, there was bipartisan postal reform, there were bipartisan bills on violence against women, there was the corrections and updating of the Electoral Count Act, and there was the bipartisan China Competition Act. I mean, you know, it was just, it was an amazing run, considering it came in between two Trump campaigns, and you know, Trump, who's kind of famous for saying the quiet part out loud, basically said, "I want to run on immigration. Don't solve it." That was the essential, the bottom line. And, you know, Langford was extremely depressed and upset about it. And, you know, one of the key success factors is that the people doing the negotiating have to be empowered and trusted by their party leaders. They have to be negotiating for their party. And that's what he thought he was doing. But it turned out, you know, that he wasn't. You know, once the House Speaker, who's a very close ally of Trump, said that it had no chance, it would be dead on arrival in the House, then the Senate Republicans just kind of moved on and said, you know, why should we bother with it? Let's just do what we know we need here, the Ukraine aid, the Israel aid, the Gaza aid. So there you have it. You know, that was the end of that. Election years are really bad, really bad. Campaigns are really bad for compromise, because it's now the situation where you don't want the other guy to get credit, the other side to get credit for anything, and that's just terrible for the country. The other thing that's going on, and you can interrupt me anytime if I'm going on too long with you know, the people, for instance, who were negotiating the budget in 2014 or 2015 were Patty Murray, who was still there as head. Now she's head of the Appropriations Committee in the Senate, Democrat from Washington State. And at that time, it was Paul Ryan. Before he became Speaker, he was the head of the House Budget Committee. And they, you know, they knew they had to get something done. They knew they had to compromise. The House was controlled by Republicans, and the Senate was controlled by Democrats. They knew they had to get this done. It's not like that anymore. You know, 8 Republicans in the House toppled Kevin McCarthy because he made a debt and budget deal with President Biden. You know, there's just this absolutist viewpoint where if we can't get everything we want, even though we're this tiny fraction of America, and clearly, you know, others do not want this because they did not elect, a Freedom Caucus president or a Freedom Caucus Senate, you know, we're going to hold out anyway. And that just kills negotiations. It's a killer.
Well, and it seems to me that there's no loyalty there either. Look, they got rid of McCarthy. They're talking about getting rid of the new speaker. I mean, it you know, that seems to me to be so troubling that they're so disorganized on the Republican side of things, where they control the House, so it seems like they have no direction at all. I remember I grew up with a guy named Tip O'Neill, you know, and he ruled, right? And you know, he used to say the best way to get along is to go along. And it seems that doesn't exist anymore. Is that true? Is that just on the Republican side, or do you think that also plagues the Democrats?
You know, I'm on a lot of mailing lists from Capitol Hill, and the only time I ever saw the progressive left defy Nancy Pelosi, it had to do, I believe, with a COVID situation where there was some leftover money from something that was supposed to go for something else, and they rebelled, and she needed them, and so she gave in. And the upshot was that they never were able to give the administration the money, some extra money to publicize a vaccine program, or maybe it was a booster. But, you know, it was. I noticed it, and I still remember it because it was so rare. You know, the Democratic left wants what it wants, but the disagreements, they understand that, you know, they may not get what they want as fast as they want it or as big as they want it, but anything that kind of nudges in the right direction after they've made their best shot, taken their best shot. I mean, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act is a perfect example of that. You know, Democrats voted for that and passed it alone in the Senate. In fact, they did it in the Senate and the House. There were no Republican votes for that, And, you know, it was a compromise. When you're negotiating with Joe Manchin from West Virginia, you're kind of negotiating with a Republican in some respects, you know, with people, you know, somebody who wants fossil fuels to be healthy for the time being, at least, and, you know, somebody who doesn't want to spend a lot of money and is very worried about the deficit. And so they did get his vote, and they needed every last vote because they made compromises with him, and they needed every last vote, so Bernie Sanders voted for that. I mean, you know, it was just one of these examples of how Democrats understand reality. I think Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, who is from Louisiana, very conservative state, very conservative district, and was one of Trump's closest allies, continues to be, I think he's kind of getting a crash course in the rest of the country. You know, his negotiating partner is Chuck Schumer from Brooklyn, you know, or Queens. You know, he's learning about a whole bunch of people who don't want the same things that his people want and that he wants. And he sees the impossibility of imposing the will of a tiny minority. In the case of Ukraine aid, it's a tiny minority in the House. You know, it would pass with 300 votes. You know, it's just not representative even of the Republican Party overall. So that's what he's up against. And
well, and that's a very disturbing fact, I think, is that you know, when you're talking about things like Ukraine and you look at the polling that's been done with Americans, we support aid to Ukraine, and as you point out, Republicans support it too. I'm a Democrat, but Republicans support it too, and you know, so it, you know, it just flies in the face of conventional wisdom that these people who have to rely on popular support are going against the grain just to satisfy this small group. How does this small group get a foothold? Is it because of Donald Trump? Because he's got their back, so to speak?
Well, I mean, I think the Tea Party movement of 2010 was part of it. You know, that was kind of the roots. And Sarah Palin, who, you know, kind of wasn't part of the mainstream of Republican politics when she came in, both in populist ways and also in policy ways, but also, you know, she wasn't all that steeped in national issues coming from Alaska, from
or
a governorship.
Anything beyond being able to see Russia from her back door. I mean, you know, and that's another thing that gets me is that, you know, these guys don't get it. You know, you've got Katie Britt giving the you know, reaction to the State of the Union, right? And then you have the other senator, one of my favorites, Tuberville, who wants to dismantle the military. You have him saying that, well, she's a housewife, referring to the other United States senator from Alabama as a housewife when they're trying to impress women. Really? I mean,
it's,
you know,
insane.
Nothing wrong with being a housewife. My wife was one for many years before she went to graduate school and became a librarian. But do you really describe the other United States senator that way? They just, it seems to me that they don't even get it, but they seem to be popular. What do you think this is? Do you think it's that people are just fed up? And they want to, you know, I have this theory that it's like, you know, throwing your shoes into the machine, you know, sabotage. It's that you're just so disgruntled with the way things are going that you want to mess everything up because you think chaos is a better solution than the status quo. Do you think that?
I think that's part of it. But then the other part is the Republican elite that doesn't want their taxes raised at all for any reason, and are afraid Biden might do that. I don't know how it's all going to play out ultimately, because I think abortion is going to be huge. And I've actually written about the Katie Britt situation and the whole, you know, there were four Republican women senators who had an op-ed in the Washington Post the other day calling, you know, passionately for a monument on the Mall for women's suffrage. And I was not impressed. This was a piece for the Bulwark. I mean, basically, I said I was rolling my eyes because, you know, they have huge problems with women. They've had that whole kitchen thing with Katie Britt, which backfired, and they've had abortion, which is just bringing women to the polls in droves, and and Biden is creeping up among women. I think the latest Quinnipiac poll had him at 60% of women, and Trump at like 35. So, you know, it's not a good. So what is the answer? Go back to the 19th century suffrage movement? No, and I don't think so. You know. And so it's, you know, I don't think they have the answers on women, and it's just, you know, they're out of touch, but Trump is in touch with kind of the, how do you want to say it? Well, just people who want entertainment and don't take things seriously, or they have some one thing that they liked, or they only get sort of half the picture, like farmers who think that Trump did really well by them, but that was a bailout, what he did. His tariff wars, his trade wars were very harmful to a lot of the people that voted to elect him. And, you know, he's planning the same sort of thing coming up. You know, there's going to be massive price increases apparently for the kind of tariffs he's talking about, and I'm sure that the Biden administration, which has kept some of the tariffs for reasons that are beyond me, but I think not to rock the boat, and some people might like them, but you know, and the economy seems to be doing okay. They're not costing jobs, so at this point, I really hope they get onto this. I'm sure they will, but a lot of what he does is counterproductive. I mean, the Exhibit A is vaccines.
Yeah.
People died because Trump would not take ownership of what I consider to be his major, possibly only, like, massive accomplishment, and I don't know how involved he was in it either, but he was. You know, his administration certainly put the rush with Operation Warp Speed and got the vaccines, which have, you know, just absolutely changed everything and restored life as we know it.
And the abortion thing is really, I mean, my daughters are infuriated about it. My wife, who's the mother of three children, is infuriated about it because of what it says to about the control of over women's lives. You know, it's not even for them. It's not even so much the issue itself as much as it what it represents to them. As you know, stay the hell out of my life. You know, we all believe, I think, on my side, we believe that if men needed abortions, they'd be able to get them at ATMs. I forget what politician said that, but you know, it's absolutely true, right? No, nobody doubts that if this was an issue that just affected men, it would have been resolved a long time ago. And I think that's they've really made a mistake there. But of course, we make mistakes too. You know, if you believe that Colin Kaepernick has the right to kneel down during the national anthem at a football game, I understand that. I understand your support of his First Amendment freedom of expression. But if you're a Democrat and you don't understand why that infuriates people, like veterans who have stood up for this country and stood up for the flag, why that upsets them, then you're not getting it. And I think that's a problem that we have. We don't get some of this stuff. We don't understand.
Well,
we're not out there. You know, I just came from Nebraska. I can tell you, it's a great opening line when you sit there and you talk to people and say, "Hi, I'm a United States Senator." They open up to you and they tell you what they think. And I just came back actually from several days in Las Vegas, and I talked to people, and people are upset with the Democrats too. They feel like we're not getting it. And I think that, you know, it would do us all well to send our politicians home more often so they can talk to people that you know, and we live in a bubble here in Washington and New York and Los Angeles, and sometimes I don't think we get it either. But what do you think?
Well, I mean, the patriotism. I mean, I've argued for many years, and lots of my colleagues have too, about Democrats kind of being more demonstrative about their patriotism.
Yes.
But it's kind of, you know, it's the whole idea of Trump going to a cop's funeral after his, quote, hostages / supporters are in jail for attacking cops, you know, and leading to the deaths of some of them.
Right.
I just, you know, I can't, I understand Democrats, and I regret that, you know, for so many years I was not, you know, kind of showing I cared, as I put it once. But after 9/11, which I happened to see from, I was in New Jersey, right across the river, and watching the towers fall when that happened. And, you know, that was it for me. That changed my whole outlook. I get what you're saying, and I've watched the other things that I've covered many, many, many presidential campaigns. And when John Kerry was the nominee, he was desperately trying to recapture patriotism. I mean, he had served, and you know,
honorably,
he
in a tough position as a swift boat captain. It was
right.
One of the most dangerous positions in Vietnam.
Right, and his crew made an ad, and one of them said the decisions he made saved lives. And it was so frustrating when he was attacked for that, you know, and,
yes,
and attacked for coming back and objecting to the war.
Yes.
And but I mean, that was a real, you know, he had the military on stage. He, you know, the first thing he said at the convention was John Kerry reporting for duty. It was sort of corny, but you know, I still remember it, so that's something, right?
Yeah.
And he really tried, and it just, you know, it did not work. And so
I campaigned for him on Indian reservations in Minnesota. We decided that Minnesota was a place that he had to win, and that Native Americans vote Democratic. They almost solidly vote Democratic, but they don't vote very often because they have their own tribal elections and stuff. So I was sent to 3 Indian reservations in Minnesota, and we got, and our job was not to try to convince anybody of anything, just to get them out to vote. We got them out to vote, and we won Minnesota. And then I sat next to a young woman who worked 18 hours a day while we were out there, and she cried all the way back to Washington. And I assured her that, you know, sometimes the Democrats would win. She was just so heartbroken because we won in Minnesota, and she couldn't believe we lost the election. But yeah, I get it. And you know, for some reason, it doesn't ring true for us. And, you know.
Well, it's a critical, you know, liberals are critical patriots. They,
yeah,
they're always trying to make things better. But I remember writing something once about just going down my street and doing a car census to see how many American cars were on the block. There were like 2,
yeah,
you know, on a whole block. And one of them was mine, but we also had a Japanese car at that time, I think. And it was around when Obama was trying to make the decision of whether to let the car companies go under or not.
yeah. Well, you know, I'm a Democratic politician, so I drive a Chrysler. You know, but my wife drives a Toyota. I mean, you know, I can't convince. She has a nice little hybrid car that she loves because she's a school librarian and has to drive 20 miles to work each way every day. So, you know, getting 50 miles to a gallon is important to her, and I just can't convince her to drive my Harley.
I did not understand this whole issue, and then I was going to Michigan to cover something, and I was trying to get to a union headquarters, and I was complete. Oh, I walked into the airport, and they said, "Is a foreign car okay?" And I thought, "What the hell? Are, you know, or is it a Toyota?
Yeah.
Okay, something like." But
yeah,
why are they asking me this? I said, "Sure." So the guy is like walking me through the directions, and as I approach, we're on the phone, and as I approach the union hall, he goes, "Is that you in a Toyota?"
Yeah.
like, oh God,
yeah,
now I get it. Now I really get it. But
yeah, I remember
so
the GM plant had a sign that said, "We support your right to own a Japanese car, and we request that you park it there. You know, don't park it on a parking lot. Park it in Japan. You bought it. You know, yeah, they're tough.
That's funny.
They're tough. And let me tell you, the greatest thing that I ever did in my entire political career was I was a Teamster for a year. And I'll tell you, that has served me well in life, to stand up before a union and say I'm a former Teamster.
Mm-hmm.
I was forced to be a Teamster against my will. I mean, they unionized our truck. I lied about my age. I was a truck driver, and we were delivery drivers. So we were kind of on the cusp. But I'm from North New Jersey, which obviously you know, right across the river from Manhattan. And our company was out of New Jersey, and they were all union truck drivers. So they made us, even though we were here in Washington, they made us be union truck drivers too, and it's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. God bless the union, and just to be honest about it, I started working full time when I was 14. I was an orphan, so it was the first time I got a day off. It was the first time I got health insurance. It was the first time I got a Christmas bonus, which, by the way, at 17 was a bottle of scotch and a carton of Camel cigarettes, along with the week's pay. And they gave me the scotch in the morning before they put me in the truck to drive. So I often chide the local guy. I say, what would your lawyer say about that today, giving a 17-year-old a bottle of scotch and saying, have fun, be safe. It served me well, and until this day, even my business cards have a union bug on them. I'm a big supporter of union labor, but yeah, they take it really, really seriously out there, and I get that. But what do you know, the thing that bothers me most is we see in these local polls that in several critical states, Trump's still ahead in the polls. Now, I just saw a new poll coming out of Pennsylvania, which shows that Biden's ahead in Pennsylvania. But there are other places like Georgia and Arizona where he's not, and these are critical states. What do you think happens if Trump gets elected? I mean, if Trump doesn't get elected, what do you think happens? Do you think that the gridlock continues, or do you think there'll be a softening on Capitol Hill if he's not in the White House?
Well, if he's not at the White House, I mean, after most elections, there's a bit of a there's a period where people want to accomplish things no matter what party they are. You know, there's like a 2-year period. This did not happen for Barack Obama. Everything that he did, he had to do with Democrats only because, you know, Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and the Republicans in charge just decided they were going to block everything he did, never give him an accomplishment, make him a one-term president. And so none of that happened. He was able to accomplish things, but it was quite different in the 2 years of the first 2 years of Joe Biden. It could have been different for Donald Trump, but he was, you know, it was just so ironic. He comes in as the great master deal maker, you know, the author of The Art of the Deal, and I named my book after his, The Art of the Political Deal, which is available on Amazon, I should say. Yeah, I mean, it's used in classes because it's got so much insight. I was doing it for Brookings, which was different than doing it for a newspaper or news outlet. And I had a lot of people talking to me, you know, on background. In other words, I could use their quotes but not their names, and that allowed them to be very honest about how they negotiated. And, you know, one of the keys to the Murray and Ryan negotiation was she was in Washington State and he was in Wisconsin, and they were doing a lot of texting, and they were not in a room with a bunch of press people waiting outside. I love my journalists, my fellow journalists, but it is, you know, tough when you're trying to do this. And they had common ground. They made football bets, things like that. I mean, it was a pleasant relationship. And she's been great still with Susan Collins. They've done a lot together on the Appropriations Committee. So that's, you know, I mean, you see odd couples doing things. Kay Granger, the Texas Republican head of the House Appropriations Committee, and Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut, one of the most liberal members of Congress, bar none. They worked it out. You know, they got to, they figured out their spending situation, and they got it done. So, I mean, and I'm not saying it's only women, because it isn't always only women, but they did great jobs. So, but Trump, you know, well, I just, you know, if I could just read you a little bit from...
Yeah, please.
Trump is a nightmare negotiating partner, which I wrote in 2017. And the subhead there is, you never know when he's going to insult you, thwart you, or suddenly change his mind. And this is absolutely... You know, he had a dizzying reversal on the North American Free Trade Agreement because two cabinet secretaries showed him a map of who'd be hurt if he killed the pact with Canada and Mexico, his own voters. And then I said, but you wouldn't be safe in assuming he'll change his mind if he learns something will hurt his voters, because if that were the case, he'd be trying to save the Affordable Care Act, because there's plenty of evidence and even a map that shows the House Republican health plan, which was kind of very minimalist and haphazard, would hit hardest by far in the states that Trump carried. A lot of times it depends on who was the last person he talked to, or which way the wind is blowing among Republicans in Congress, or maybe what a foreign leader says. You know, these are not how to get to yes.
The real pillars,
you know, can you rely on your negotiating partner to be consistent, to not leak or tweet or make counterproductive headlines, to be truly interested in a win-win outcome and understand what that will take? Those are the keys.
Yeah, and you know, I've been in politics for 40 years, and one of the things is that's just amazed me is that Trump has broken all the cardinal rules. First of all, you don't attack women, right? Because they vote more mm-hmm. than men. They make a bigger part of the population. They're a larger part of the population. So you never, you know, there's some sacred things. Veterans are sacred. Mothers are sacred. You know, you don't attack them. And you don't attack the press. The press are the last people, right? When I was a Democratic staffer, when I was working for the DNC, we used to go to these, like the convention. I've been to every convention since 1980. And you go to the convention, and you'd be standing in line at some arena paying $6 for a piece of bad pizza. And across the hall from you would be the staff lounge where there was free roast beef and liquor and, you know, everything, right? And because we lauded the press. You never fought with them. You never got up in their face. You never stood in front of a crowd and said, look at the cameras in the back. These people are disgusting. The idea that you would do something like that was just incredible, you know? But he's done all of that, and he succeeded at it, and it's just crazy to me. He's defied every rule in the book, and you know, I hope it's just this group of core supporters that he has. That he, you know, my basic feeling is he couldn't win in the last election. He won't be able to win in this one, but. You know, I got to tell you, I've got two daughters who, you know, 31 and 26, and they both say to me, Dad, Joe Biden's really, really old. And I say, yeah, he is really, really old, but he's really, really steady and really, you know, he's the hand we need, right?
He's future-oriented, very much so.
And he's done a good job, you know, but that doesn't seem to matter as much as the rhetoric does, and you know, and it's just crazy. You know, I have my first assistant worked at she was volunteering. She was a bartender at Comet Pizza, and I don't know if you remember the whole Comet Pizza thing where the guy walked in with the semi-automatic.
Oh yeah, I was across the street in a church.
Yeah,
that was happening.
And luckily the community stood up, right? Rachel called in sick for 2 weeks because she said people were coming in and buying a beer and leaving her $100 tip because they felt so bad about, you know, about what had happened. But, you know, they still talk about, there's still people that believe that, Hillary Clinton and you know, other politicians were molesting children in a basement. And if you've ever been in Comet Peachy, you know they don't even have a basement. It's one floor. And
it's,
you know,
3 blocks from my house, and we go there all the time.
Yeah, everybody.
So, I mean,
right?
it was absolutely shocking. I mean,
yeah.
I was at a concert, and there were, you know, when I came out, we thought, we couldn't figure out what was going on because there were helicopters flying around.
The
and the These singers, it was like a little religious a cappella group from Minnesota, and they were very annoyed because they were getting drowned out. And they had closed Connecticut Avenue, and
right.
Mayor Bowser was giving a press briefing in the middle of the road. So when we came out, so I decided to put on my press hat and listen, and it was just astonishing. I mean, there were police all over the place, police lines to try to get to your car, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and there are people that still believe. But, you know, it still comes up. I can't imagine. You know, you'll be listening to some talk show or something, and it still comes up in conversation. It's crazy. And, you know, God bless the Internet. No matter how crazy you are, you can find somebody that agrees with you on the Internet.
It's just
horrible. And
so
what role as a reporter, as a seasoned reporter that's done so many things in journalism, I'm not kidding when I say it would take half the show just to read your resume. But given that, what's the role of the media and reporters? What do they need to do in the upcoming election? You know, it seems to me that I watch CNN or watch MSNBC and I hear one story, and then I listen to Hannity and I listen to those other people because I want to know how the other side thinks. And it's totally the opposite. It's the stuff that comes out of their mouths is just crazy. And you know, do journalists have an obligation to police themselves? Or is freedom of the press just freedom of whatever you want to say?
You know, there's a misinformation epidemic, and, you know, it's the only, you know, the only thing that I could see happening and it's only a partial solution, is lawsuits. The fact that Fox News talked a lot about the big lie and the election results as being rigged and false, and the fact that they attacked companies that weren't well-known, they were background players, you know, in election administration
right.
and software and all that, and their employees were getting death threats and having to leave their homes and like things like that. I mean, when you've got people who aren't famous, who aren't public figures, companies that aren't, you know, famous, aren't public figures, public, you know, like not Disney. I doubt Disney could, you know, win a defamation suit. I don't know, but it's you know, the courts can deliver justice, and they did deliver it in the lawsuit that filed against Fox
by the two Georgia ladies.
Excuse me.
Was that the two Georgia ladies?
Oh well, that one. That was
another
suit against Trump. That was another one about disinformation that involved people who, you know, were not public figures until, unfortunately, they were attacked in the most awful, racist, and false terms. And, you know, so there's one of the, I mean, the voting companies are still coming at Fox. There may be more. I mean, I'm not sure that they would have hired Ronna McDaniel because they might have been nervous about her association with what they just paid nearly $800 million in, you know, settlement for. So, you know, that's, you know, if you're a reporter for a news organization, and if you're an editor for a news organization, and if you're an opinion writer, either for a news organization or you want your opinion piece published with a news organization, your obligation is to the facts. And if there's a mistake or a lie in your piece, then, you know, it's got to be corrected. And I just, you know, I hope that people keep filing lawsuits about all this stuff, because it seems like that may be the only way to stop the just the proliferation of all this stuff and the way it eats into people's brains. I mean, Michael Flynn, I believe, was promoting Pizzagate at Comet,
yeah.
and that, you know, there's
yes,
there's
was.
Just people you would never think would get into this.
Well,
and Rudy Giuliani.
Oh, Rudy. Really just
he was the one involved in Georgia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and the facts don't seem to matter anymore. I mean, it seems to me you've got the Republican election official from in charge in Georgia and the Republican election official in charge of Arizona saying that the election wasn't rigged, but it didn't matter. You know, right? It you know, it wasn't Democrats saying this. It was Republicans saying this. And you've worked on a lot of elections, and I've worked on a lot of elections, and there are no more honest people than those people that show up to work the polls. You know, every one of them, I've never met one of them in the hundreds that I've met over the years that isn't there because they believe in the process and they want to make America a better place by being honest and forthright. And if there's anybody stealing elections, it's certainly not them. You know, they work their, that's been my experience, is that they're all there, they're all volunteers, and they all are about as honest as people get. So it was just crazy to me when the Republicans were saying no, it was the election was not rigged, that still people believe it's rigged. I just don't
get it.
Where the facts don't matter.
Yeah, you know, I once wrote a whole column about what if Trump apologized for his mistakes, just like the fake news media, and it was pretty. I mean, this was in 2017, still at a time when I could write, you know, funny stuff about him, and it was coming off of, he had gone nuts over a David Weigel, something a Post reporter at that time had incorrectly said, and it had to do with crowd size, of course, because that's
right,
his preoccupation, and he demanded an apology and a retraction, and 3 minutes later, the reporter tweeted, "Sure thing, I apologize," but that wasn't good enough, because Trump then tweeted, "Fake news, he should be fired."
I just started writing
up these press releases, you know, where he, you know, apologized over doubting Obama's birth certificate, and he apologized for his assertions of rampant fraud. You know, he apologized for lying about the I don't know. He doesn't change the playbook, right?
Didn't he attack Nikki Haley on the same basis that her parents weren't born in the United States, so she therefore wasn't an American citizen? I mean, it seems that he doesn't, even though he gets lambasted for this stuff, he never changes the playbook, and it still seems to resonate with people. It's just, in my opinion, that's the hardest thing to deal with, and maybe it is for you as well as a journalist, is that, you know, he's out of touch with reality. I just came from the grocery store, and somebody saw the license plates on my car that say United States Senator. So they stopped and they talked to me. Very often they curse at me through the traffic, you know. And I've gotten to the point where they say, "Do you know what's wrong with you people?" And I now say, "Yes, I got the memo this morning. We're working it all out. Thanks a lot," you know, because everybody wants to give you their opinion. They've attacked my children in the car, you know, but anyway. This woman said to me, well, you know, Joe Biden's screwing everything up. And I go, where in the world do you get the idea that Joe Biden is screwing everything up? You know, it flabbergasts me that this is the this is the way people think. Well, we've got about another 5 minutes, so I want to ask you, what is it? Do you want to talk about the Rona McDaniel thing? Because I know you've written about that as well. Where is there an autumn, you know, you seem like a Lazarus out there looking for the, you know, the one honest Republican that can comment. Is there one? Is there one out there? Is there
I mean, I would call them conservatives or libertarians. Some of them are no longer Republicans, but some of them are. And we found many of them when I was working at USA Today as an opinion editor. We had two conservatives on the staff who had a lot of contacts. And we were able to, we had a lot of points of view from people who were conservative and who, you know, maybe they weren't writing about Trump. Maybe they were writing about, you know, some issue their think tank was involved in, or, you know, conservative issues, at least the conservative traditional kind, like excessive regulation or something like that. You know, there were issues that and pieces that we could very much support having and could be fact-checked, and that was fine. And there are people now today, I mean, you know, you think Ken Buck wouldn't write an honest op-ed. He's the Colorado congressman who is in the Freedom Caucus, and he's quitting. And then there's Mike Gallagher, who thought that the Mayorkas, the DHS secretaries of impeachment, quote-unquote, was ridiculous. He voted against it. He's getting primaried. He decided to retire. He's the head of the China Committee. You know, it seems to me I'd have him on any time to talk about China or write a piece about China. I mean, I don't know if I would pay people huge amounts of money you need to have Mike Johnson on. He's Speaker of the House, right? He's also a Trump ally who helped try to overturn the election. So I'm not sure if he left Congress suddenly that I would pay him $300,000 a year to be a commentator. But, you know, as an important person, or even as an important formerly important person, you know, you'd have him on. It's like what NBC did just seems way a bridge too far, paying someone, you know, to become part of your stable who was so involved in all that's wrong with the Republican Party, including the lie. You know,
so why don't
gotta
we see
be
more,
a dividing line.
So why don't we see more of people like Mike Pence? Is he being closed out by the Republican Party, or is that his decision, you think, to stay in the background right now? Because there's no one. You know, we had Michael Steele, who was head of the Republican Party, on the show. I interviewed him a few years ago. He was also the lieutenant governor of Maryland. But I asked him about Larry Hogan, and I said, you know, lots of people talk about Larry Hogan as a potential candidate because he was the well-loved governor of Maryland. And he said, well, Hogan won't run because he realizes he can't get through the primary. No Republican will run at this point because they realize they can't beat Trump in the primary. So if you can't get past the primary, it doesn't matter. So is that the case? Has he just shut down any opposition in the Republican Party, do you think?
I think it really depends on the race. It depends on the state or the House district. There are some times when the Trump person doesn't win the primary. There were a lot of times when the Trump person did win the primary in 2022 and then went on to lose because people were just kind of like, my gosh, you know, this person is just out of touch with reality. I'm thinking of Georgia Senate race for one. But, Trump went for the celebrity in Pennsylvania, and he lost, you know, that was Dr. Oz. He lost to John Fetterman, who was, you know, his own kind of unique person.
As a guy that used to sell men's clothes, that's how I worked my way through college, working for a place called Breaches of Georgetown. I would say he's unique. Well, we're running out of time here, so tell people how they can get their book. You've been an amazing guest, and you're welcome back anytime. And I so want to contribute to the cookbook, so I'm going to send you my spaghetti recipe. But please tell people how they can get your book.
The book is available on Amazon. We published it on Amazon, and it's The Art of the Political Deal. And you can get it in Kindle or paperback. And if you want to know how it's done, I mean, it'll be kind of depressing because it'll show how it's not being done at the moment because people don't see any incentive, at least while Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee. Maybe
well, I think
change.
It's an important read and that everybody should look at it. So I encourage people to go out and get a copy of it. And
well,
I hope
so
that you and I can get together sometime and have a slice of pizza at Comet together because we go there. We go there all the time. And like I say, they've been very nice to me every time I've had an election night party or anything. It's been at Comet. And so get some pizza, buy the book. You know what? You can buy the book. You could probably get it at Politics and Prose as well. Can you?
I'm not sure about that. It came out a while back. It's been 7 years, so I would go with Amazon.
Okay, go with Amazon. Get a copy of the book. Go get a slice of pizza. And Jill Lawrence, thank you so much. We always play our show off the air with a song that we dedicate to the whatever wonderful guests we've had. And today was an easy choice. Here's a little Help for My Friends by the Beatles. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
What would you think if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends. Give the people their right to vote.